Mediated conversation on SAFM.
27 minutes now to 9. Time for a special edition of your mediated conversation. 3 weeks ago, the Zondo Commission heard testimony from the person we believe may be its final witness, the current president, Cyril Ramaphosa. It was the beginning of the end of a process which saw incredible stories about corruption, sometimes alleged corruption, being detailed in public. We finally got to hear what was happening in government during the era that so many people now call the era of state capture. One of the people who played a big role in trying to stop state capture during this period was Mkhubisi Jonas. He was the deputy finance minister, the person who went public back in 2016 to explain how the Guptas had offered him a huge amount of money to become the finance minister. You could argue it was partly because of what he did that the direction of our country changed. Well, he's been watching the Zondo Commission as you've been watching it, as you've been listening to it. He was in government for much of the time during all of these events. Like you, he would have watched and listened to President Cyril Ramaphosa testify, as you watched him testify 3 weeks ago. And Mkhubisi Jonas is here now. Mr. Jonas, good morning. It's been a long term. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning, Stephen. Good morning to listeners.
The Zondo Commission went on for nearly 3 years. It became, I think, almost a fixture of life. We became used to it, in a way. How would you assess the role that it played? What role do you think it's played in our country?
Look, I mean, it has played a very critical role in many ways. I think at one level, I think it helped to generate evidence about state capture. I mean, give details, I think. We had many skeptics at the beginning. I mean, people doubting whether state capture existed. Also, theoretical postulations about state capture and its impossibility. The reality, I think, of evidence led in the Zondo Commission showed that, I think, state capture was a reality, in fact, a reality, and it was deeper and systematic than we think. And also, cut across all sectors of society in that sense.
I mean, one of the things about this era is it's completely multiracial. You know, there are representatives of every race in South Africa involved in state capture. It's an incredible thing that shows you how it actually works. Its tentacles went everywhere.
Indeed. I mean, I guess I think it also reveals some of the structural weaknesses in our society. Because I think I always feel that state capture and corruption is not just a moral default of certain individuals, but it's also, I think, a reflection of systemic flaws in our system, political system, in the economic system, and in the social fabric of society. It did actually bring all of those to the fore.
You talk about, I mean, so often we spend time talking about, well, if we change the law, this will fix this problem. What we really need to do is change structures. We need to change something sometimes almost more fundamental than the law. I mean, when you watch the Zondo Commission and you think to yourself, you know, we need to, in a way, rebuild the state. Where do we even start with this? I mean, you talked about our political system.
Look, I mean, again, I mean, we can have a long debate about it. But for me, I think the big lesson that came out of the Zondo Commission was managing better the relationship between the state and the party. Hmm. Because I think that our current system is such that we vote a political party, and the political party actually passes over the mandate to the NEC, its national executives. National executives tend to pass it to national working committees. It ends up being left with one person. Now, the process, I mean, of capturing is just capture that person, which is the president in the case, and the rest is almost history. It happens almost naturally as it flows from that. So that also means that you capture the state effectively. Because, I mean, a host of measures, deployment, policy direction, etc., is pretty much linked back to the party. And the conflation between the two means that actually weaknesses in the party finds expression in the state very easily and directly, as we have seen in the last couple of months, actually demonstrated quite practically. So I think the big lesson is that we probably, in rebuilding the state, we probably need to think about ways of demarcation between what is the party's role and the state. I mean, and really try to ensure that in the structuring of bureaucracy and processes of appointments, etc., we actually ensure that there is a line between what the party does and the state does, and actually coordinate the bureaucracy from the state. I mean, a couple of proposals. I mean, being branded around. One of them is probably having an independent commission that does the appointments of director generals. So you have a technical process at least before you get into the political process of the cabinet, and really respect the outcome of the technical process, not just use it as a facade to kind of legitimize what anyway you're going to take as a political decision.
I wonder how the deployment committee of the ANC feels about what's being suggested. I mean, that we knew. I mean, we knew there was such a thing as a deployment committee, but we'd never heard so much about it before.
Look, I mean, I guess. I mean, again, I mean, these things happen, and probably with good intentions. But I think that it was demonstrated in the last couple of years, they can be completely abused. I mean, I always held a view that all South Africans have the right to employment in the public sector, and the deployment committee is likely to look at what is within its reach, ANC members. And the public sector is broader than just ANC members. It serves the country. So in my view is that, yes, political considerations are important when we make these appointments, but I think they should be based on solid technical grounding. And that's why I think the separation should be made.
I wonder if it's tempting to just forget about the Zondo Commission. You know, there'll be some people who will think, well, we can just forget about it. It happened, it's done. But I think that, you know, I find that voters are not going to forget it very easily. And I say that based on the people who call in, the people who make comments. People talk about the Zondo Commission all the time. So I suppose what I'm trying to say is, do you think it has definitively, absolutely, in some way changed our country?
It has. I mean, think about it. Before the Zondo Commission, I think when people talked about state capture and corruption, there were many people who doubted the existence of such. In fact, I mean, in many instances, I think this was branded as reactionary, because I think it's not understanding that the state is an instrument of transformation. It has to be used as such, etc., etc. And therefore, there's also, I think, an inherent perspective in the political system that whatever the ANC says politically is correct. I mean, so what the Zondo Commission has shown is that actually truth is bigger and lies in places that are currently not considered to be places where it should be. But also the solutions are the same. I don't think we should have by any illusion that solutions are likely to come to the from the ANC or the political parties. I think as this is increasingly becoming clear, the leadership is coming all over the place. It's all over the place. I mean, society has risen up to the challenge, and as was shown in a couple of weeks when we had the uprisings that happened.
I mean, I've been fascinated. There's a weakness in our state that wasn't always apparent. It's been growing over the years, but a weakness in our state is a major problem. I was listening to Adele Kirsten the other day, and she made the point, she runs Gun Free SA, but she studied violence for many years, and she always says a weaker state leads to more violence. And I mean, I think we're seeing that in society. I think there's a weakness in our state now.
Indeed, I mean, I think it has been weakened, my view is that deliberately and systematically over time. I mean, in order to sustain state capture and corruption, you needed weaker security structures and you needed weaker institutions. And I think that has happened over and over time. Boards were appointed, weak boards were appointed, weak commissioners, police commissioners were appointed. And people deployed in particular strategic position within the security cluster were there to serve particular purposes as opposed to driving national security, as it were, and safety. And I think at a point where we are now, this is, I mean, just pure technical capacity, forensic capability in many of the investigative authorities was completely obliterated in the period that we're talking about. And rebuilding that is crucial. But my view is that I think the process of rebuilding, I think, must start with recognition that there's a problem. And I think the Zondo Commission has helped us actually recognize that the problem, there is a problem, and also framed the problem to a certain extent.
You were there, SAFM. It's your mediated conversation, special edition of the mediated conversation. Nkobisi Jonas, former Deputy Finance Minister, with us 17 minutes now to 9. I was thinking about how to put this question, to put it correctly, but let me put it like this. I think it's virtually unarguable that the person who allowed the era of state capture to happen, who enabled the corruption, to put it another way, the person who's most often blamed for what happened is our former president, Jacob Zuma. He's the person who actually appointed you deputy finance minister. It was his friends, the Guptas, who tried to corrupt you. How do you feel about the former president now?
Look, I've almost tried, I mean, and consistently so, to depersonalize this thing. Because I think the danger is, I mean, arguing that state capture was just about Zuma. State capture was enabled by the fact that the political system allowed him and supported him to do whatever happened at the time. So if you take the view that it is a personal matter, so the removing him solves the problem. The truth of the matter is that it doesn't solve the problem, because the systems, the structures remain intact, and that's why I think I shudder to think that our institutions are at their weakest. There's a rebuilding happening, but the danger for state capture exists. I mean, today, as it existed a couple of months ago, years ago. So my view is that I think you've got to reform the party and the political system. You've got to reform, obviously, clearly the economy, and you've got to address issues of inclusion, because some of these narratives, I mean, propagated by Bell Pottinger, penetrated society easily because of the historical fixtures in our society, as it were.
So I mean, I take the point that that this should be depersonalized. So let me sort of put another question around this in a different way. Is part of the rebuilding process, or the process of whatever we want to call it, the ANC calls it renewal of the ANC, some people call it the reform of government, a constitutional court ordering a former president to go to jail and that person actually going to jail, is that part of that process?
It is. Because, I mean, what it signals, it's a triumph for the rule of law. I've been reading some of the commentary from international media and some of our friends outside of South Africa. I mean, it's unthink of. I mean, South Africa still has a unique feature that government go to courts and lose cases. And in many countries, it's unthinkable. And that former presidents can go to court and lose cases and you know. And so for me, that's a good signaling thing. I mean, to show that rule of law matters and we're still upholding rule of law. Is rule of law under threat? Certainly it is. I mean, I was just watching the thing about appointment of judges and the controversy around that and so on and so on. It does show that these things are not permanent and are not a given. They have to be protected. I mean, we have to really reflect on them on a continuous basis.
All of this also involves the economy. I mean, you spoke about Bell Pottinger and the phrase WMC. And I know, I mean, I think there's been a torturous account to try and find it in an SACP document from 1950-something. But really, it seemed to have been a Bell Pottinger phrase. And yet now, it is part of our conversation. We talk about white monopoly capital all the time. The point I'm trying to get to is we had unemployment figures this week that were just, I mean, they're getting scarier and scarier. It's about young people who don't have work. You focused on looking for solutions.
Look, I mean, we have to find solutions. I mean, I think that one of the things that we should do, I mean, almost urgently, I think, is to create a new vision for the country. And a vision that, in a sense, I mean, makes sense to everybody, and everybody has a buy-in into it, so that you can have trade-offs. I mean, we do need huge trade-offs across this spectrum, from labor, from civil society, from government itself, and from the private sector. So we do need to get into that process of arriving at some kind of a new vision for the country. But part of that vision would be about, in part, I think, rebuilding the economy and in a sense, I mean, aggressively putting a package that enhances growth, but also enhances inclusivity. But I think the danger of the debate about reform is that it tends to go parallel to another debate about transformation. I think we need a debate that recognizes that structural economic reforms must actually also, in a sense, address issues of inequality, issues of poverty, etc., etc. And I don't think these are rocket science. I mean, at a technical level, you could wave the solutions together. Our problem is political. But politically, I don't think we recognize the crisis we're in and the fact that this country would crash if we don't find solutions to these fundamental problems.
I mean, the risk is it could get worse. I mean, if you look at the fourth industrial revolution, our education system, it's going to get worse.
Yeah.
And Kobisi Jonas is with us through until 9 o'clock. You're with SAFM. Your special edition of A Mediated Conversation will continue 11 minutes to 9.
Mediated Conversation on SAFM.
10 minutes to 9. Your Mediated Conversation, special edition of Mediated Conversation, continues here on SAFM. Nkobisi Jonas with us, the former Deputy Finance Minister. You'll remember the role that he played. Mr. Jonas, we need to talk, and I am going to talk now about the President's testimony at the Zondo Commission. You watched him testify. How did you feel as you watched him?
Look, I mean, I thought he could have been more direct, more forthcoming and on the issues, and both at a level of strategy, but also I think explaining more the period that we went through, which was a difficult period, by the way. I mean, people can sometimes underestimate the complexity of the period. I thought he would have been more kind of forthright and direct about those issues. I mean, one thing, a couple of things came to mind. I mean, I recall, I mean, that we had, when Des Van Rooyen came in, I recall, I mean, it's very early, it was 7 o'clock in the morning, having a meeting with him. Sure. And essentially I went there to say, hey, I'm resigning, I can't stay. And I think in a very kind of persuasive way and very strongly, I mean, they said, no, you guys can't resign. It's not right, because if you do that, you create further
chaos. Who were the other guys?
Lungisa, for instance, Fuzile also did the same. And I think, and he said at the end of the conversation, he said, give me this weekend. By Monday, this thing is not sorted out, you can resign, I'll probably join you. And I think for me, on a Sunday, when I received a call from him to say, it's done, there was both elation in his voice, but also I think the strength of commitment to that. And I think those kinds of anecdotes could have come more strongly, because they mean something about in a difficult conditions, how do you navigate your path without almost like derailing the thing. The second point, I think, is around nuclear. I mean, we had long discussions on nuclear. And I think we were, Treasury, when I look back, I think we were too strong, I mean, on opposing it. And, of course, in many instances, we could have kind of be more tactful in doing it. But, I mean, we're blunt. I mean, Lungisa is probably the bluntest person that can be. It helps sometimes. But I think his caution was that let's string the process along, prolong it, and make it difficult, and so on and so on. By the time this guy realizes he will have to go, I mean, because term would have come to an end. And I mean, it was an interesting model, which at the time was irritated me. But I think we ended up putting blocks on the road until I think there was a court process. The other interesting, I think, that I thought would have been a focus is the closure of Gupta bank accounts, I mean, which is really huge pressure for Praveen and myself, I think. I mean, because I think there was huge, huge pressure for us to intervene with the banks effectively, I mean, and so on and so on. And even in the conversation around that, he was probably amongst, he joined the forces and in many instances led the discussion to say, this country has laws, and you're not going to force people to do an illegal thing. The Treasury should not intervene, and so. Of course, I mean, a committee was set up on the other side, and so. So, but I think the fact that he had the strength to intervene in those conversations, and you have also the Border Management Agency, and people don't realize, I mean, what it actually meant, that you were actually saying take 300 billion plus minus of revenue and shift it to Home Affairs.
Sure.
That's what it meant.
Sure. Melusi Gigab.
So we had all of this discussion and so on and so on. We're opposing it from Treasury, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, he kind of was asked to intervene, and he intervened and tried to kind of continue and continue. And my sense is that he kind of string that process along until the time the act was signed, the bill was signed. There's no time to implement it. Now, imagine, if you have 300 and something billion managed by Home Affairs at the time, that would have been disaster for the country. So my point is that those kinds of incidents would have been better articulated and so on. He could have also been more forthright in terms of his vision for the country, etc., and what needs to happen. Already a lot is happening. The NPA, it's moving. It's clear. There are a couple of things happening in the NPA, etc. Those kinds of things, I would have argued, that could have been probably the cornerstone of the presentation, as it were.
You took a massive risk in 2016, and I remember it very clearly because there was the Financial Times of London story. One day, that journalist has promised never to tell me how he found out, but I think I have an idea. Then there was a press conference. Pravin Gordhan was there. I remember asking Pravin Gordhan. I was a reporter at the time. He was the Minister of Finance. And I think the phrase was, "My silence says it all." And then we knew that there was something going on and that what the Financial Times had published about you and the Guptas seemed to be true. And then I got a phone call from someone and said, "Stephen, it's all true. The deputy minister is about to publish an affidavit, and the sound's been given to the SABC. He's done an interview with the SABC, and it seemed, and that was very, very clearly when you said you'd been offered a bribe by the Guptas, and you took a massive risk when you did that. Cyril Ramaphosa was deputy president at the time. The perception is you took a massive risk, and he did nothing. That's the perception. Is that perception accurate?
No, I don't think it is accurate. I think you must also understand, Stephen. When I look back, we had a big debate about resigning and going public and so on and so on. I wrote many papers to try and motivate for that and this and that. But I think one argument that stuck in my mind was that if you go tomorrow, you would have replaced so gladly. Think about it. You move Nene and you have Des van Rooyen. That shows the arrogance of the system. And I can tell you now, if he would have done that, you would have had somebody else coming in immediately, to replace him, and the project would have continued. So I think it's the complexity of stopping a system from a kind of moving in directions that would be destructive for the country was, from in my view, very complex, I think. And there was a debate that we had in Treasury over and over time, to say that, look, the role we're playing is to kind of slow down the process. We are not stopping it. And the question is, should we stop? Should we stop slowing it down and maybe become more disruptive, as it were? Different views on that point. And I think many people said, okay, but let's continue to intensify the slowing down and so on. So it was only later that we said, oh, maybe you need another stream of trying to kind of run a public process. That only happened, quite frankly, when I went out and so on and so on, to create another stream. So you needed the internal dynamic of slowing down, monitoring and understanding what's happening, etc., etc. And for me, many people played that role very well, effectively, very well, I think, in that period. And I think the momentum that happened outside the state, in civil society and elsewhere, was because of the amount of data and information flowing out of the system. Now, if there was nobody in the system, that flow of that data and information could not have happened, quite frankly.
So President Ramaphosa did the right thing by staying on as deputy.
Look, you can look at it. History is a terrible thing in that sense, because I think you tend to look at things from your vantage point of the present. And my view is that I think if you are to have a better sense of the annals of history, is to analyze them from the point at which they happen. And I would dare say sort of should do that.
You, you don't seem to harbor any bitterness.
Look, yes, I don't, actually. I don't. I think every mishap that happened in South Africa, in every kind of crisis, should be a learning point, I think. And I think about it, like, coming out of exile and the struggle, we come up with grand ideas about the ANC and about the struggle. I mean, this is like really this heroic organization with leaders that are almost close to saints and that kind of stuff, and so on and so on. So my sense is that I think the journey of post-apartheid journey of the liberation movement has been a reality check and a process of developing a more realistic view of the world. And also helping us understand that the world is bigger than the ANC, the world is bigger than the liberation movement, that the liberation movement is supposed to serve the world as opposed to the world serving the liberation movement. That morality has to be shaped by society, not the political party. And I think that those are important lessons in my view. I mean, that and of course now I can say with probably no fear of contradiction that parties are increasingly driven more by sustaining themselves in power as opposed to kind of driving grand ideas of transformation and so on and so on. That's why you need vigilance, citizenry, to actually balance this up.
Mkhobisi Jonas, it's been good to see you. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. You look relaxed now that I'm saying goodbye. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
Mkhobisi Jonas, special edition of Your Mediated Conversation. Well, of course, we will be back tomorrow. Tomorrow, yes, Ray McClarker, tomorrow is Friday. From Zoma, Sanza, Mdu, Joey, myself, we'll see you tomorrow. Stay safe, get a vaccination, come to the SABC, you can get one. You're with SFM leading the conversation just after 9 o'clock.